Scientists have shown that happiness and social connections can have positive health benefits. Now researchers find another aspect of well-being that may add years to our lives, having a sense of purpose. NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
Do you feel you wander aimlessly through life, or do you feel you have a clear direction and know what you want? 14 years ago, researchers posed this and similar questions to more than 6,000 adults of all different ages across the U.S. And recently, psychologist Patrick Hill with Carleton University in Canada analyzed how those people are doing today.
And what we show in the study is that individuals who reported a greater sense of purpose and direction in life were more likely to outlive their colleagues by the time that we reassess them 14 years later.
In fact, people with a sense of purpose reduced their risk of death by 15% compared with those who said they were more or less aimless. And it didn't seem to matter when people found their direction. It could be in their 20s, 50s, or 70s. Hill's analysis controlled for other factors known to affect longevity, things like age, gender, emotional well-being. A sense of purpose trumped all that.
Typically, purpose is thought of as kind of a compass or a lighthouse that provides one this overarching aim and direction to follow in their day-to-day lives, as well as in their weekly and monthly activities.
Now, of course, purpose means different things to different people. Hill says it could be as simple as making sure one's family is happy. It could be bigger, like contributing to social change. It could be more self-focused, like doing well on the job. Or it could be about creativity.
Often this is individuals who want to produce something that is appreciated by others, either in written or artistic form, whether it's music, dance, the visual arts, or so on.
It's not exactly clear how purpose might benefit health. Purposeful individuals may simply lead healthier lives, but Hill says a sense of purpose may protect against the harmful effects of stress. Cornell University psychologist Anthony Burrow tested this theory. He had college student volunteers ride the train through the diverse neighborhoods of Chicago. Research shows when people are surrounded by people of different racial and ethnic groups, their levels of stress increase.
Participants were given a packet that had the name of every stop in it, and when they got to that stop, they were asked to indicate with an X for several discrete negative moods, things like scared, fearful, alone, distressed.
Prior to boarding the train, about half the students were asked to write about their sense of purpose, the other half about the last movie they saw. It turns out those who wrote about the movie felt stressed when the train was dominated by different racial and ethnic groups, and those who wrote about purpose didn't feel any stress.
So if a sense of purpose in life, in what might otherwise be a stressful context or stressful setting, can help people remain even keel, that might deter or thwart these sort of downstream negative consequences that we see.
Like all the harmful health problems of stress, including greater risk of heart disease. And that could explain why people with a sense of purpose may live longer. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
When a doctor tells a patient to undergo a test for a disease, the doctor may assume that the patient would want to know whether they have the disease. That's not always the case, though. Often people prefer not to know, fearing bad news. Here's NPR's social science correspondent, Shankar Vedantam.
There's an old theory in economics about information. It makes common sense, too. If I have some information about your finances or your health, you should be willing to hear it. Maybe my information is useful, in which case you can act on it. Maybe it's useless, in which case you can ignore it. If you are a rational person, says Josh Tassoff, an economist at Claremont Graduate University, here's one thing you should never do.
A person should never avoid information because information can never hurt a decision.
But of course, people don't always behave rationally. We like information when the news is good. And there are other times we go, I'd rather not know. There's lots of new research that documents this behavior. Social scientists call it information aversion. Tassoff and another researcher, Ananda Ganguly at Claremont McKenna College, recently decided to find out how information aversion, commonly called the ostrich effect, works in health. It's not rational to avoid accurate health information, but what if the information is unpleasant? Here's the experiment they set up. They recruited a bunch of college students. They picked a subject.
Sexually transmitted diseases.
Tassoff says it's something lots of college students worry about. The students who volunteered were told they could get tested for the herpes simplex virus, or HSV. It's a common disease that spreads via sex. It has two forms. One is unpleasant, and the other is even worse. Ganguly says the college students were given information, graphic information, that made it clear how bad herpes could be.
There were pictures guaranteed to kind of make them really not want to have the disease.
Then, once the students understood what herpes does, they were told a blood test could tell them if they had either form of the disease. Now, in previous studies into information aversion, it wasn't always clear why people declined information. So Tassoff and Ganguly set out to eliminate the confusion by setting up the experiment in a certain way. First, they wanted to make sure that students weren't declining the information because they didn't want to have their blood drawn. So Ganguly came up with a way to fix that.
We were going to draw their blood anyway and discard the blood. If you can believe it, we would draw 10 cc's of their blood and in front of them have them pour it down the sink.
If the students elected to get the blood tested for herpes, they would receive the results confidentially. So being embarrassed was eliminated as a reason to decline the information. In fact, Tassoff said, the experiment was designed to eliminate every extraneous reason someone might decline to get information.
The idea is that all the costs associated with being tested are completely controlled for.
Finally, Tassoff and Ganguly added a step to the experiment to find out not just whether students wanted to avoid the information about herpes, but how strongly they felt about not knowing. If students wanted to decline the test, Ganguly told them they had to pay $10, and he asked them to think about it carefully.
You kind of have the sense that your blood is actually going to be wasted if you want to pay the money. So you'd rather pay money, waste that blood, than know what your test results were.
Did students decline to find out if they had the disease? Yeah, quite a few. And Tassoff said there was a big difference in the number of students who avoided the test for the more unpleasant form of herpes. In fact, three times as many students paid money not to find out they had genital herpes compared to herpes that causes cold sores.
For those who didn't want to know, 85.7%, the most common explanation was because, quote, it will cause me unnecessary stress or anxiety if I test positive.
Tassoff and Ganguly say their study and the growing body of evidence on information aversion has a couple of important implications.
When we tell people, well, you should get tested for disease X or disease Y, we tell them how bad it can be if they have those diseases. It's something that we should look at as to whether we should scare people, because scaring people more about the implications may scare them away from getting tested.
There's another take-home message, Tassoff says.
Possibly, you know, an intervention that might address this is the routinization of tests. So basically not draw their attention to it.
Both these ideas need more testing. But one thing seems clear. If you want people to pay attention to their health, it doesn't make sense to stick our heads in the sand about the ostrich effect. Shankar Vedantam, NPR News.
In the last 4 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has dramatically and repeatedly expanded the rights of corporations.
The court ruled that corporations have the right to spend money in elections for public office.
It ruled that some for-profit corporations may refuse to comply with the federal mandate to cover birth control in their health plans if they have religious objections.
These are personal rights, but they are being accorded to corporations. And our listeners have sent us a lot of mail asking, in essence, when did corporations become people? So we turn that question over to NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
Corporation, defined in the dictionary as a number of persons united in one body for a purpose.
We've had the corporate entity from really medieval times.
Columbia law professor John Coffey is an authority on corporate law.
You can think of the Catholic Church as probably the first entity that could buy and sell property in its own name.
Indeed, having an artificial legal persona was especially important to churches, says Elizabeth Pullman of Loyola Law School in Los Angeles.
Because having a corporation would allow people to put property into a collective ownership that could be held with perpetual existence. So it wouldn't be tied to any one person's lifespan or subject necessarily to the laws regarding inheriting property and that sort of thing.
Later on in the United States, the advantages of incorporation were crucial to the nation's economic development. Unlike partnerships, the corporation continued to exist even if a partner died. There was no unanimity required in order to do something. The shareholders could not be sued individually. Only the corporation could be sued. So investors only risked as much as they put into buying shares. By the mid-1800s, the process of incorporating was relatively routine and corporations were common. But corporations are nowhere mentioned in the Constitution, leaving to the courts the sorting out of corporate rights. After all, Coca-Cola is a corporation, but so are the NAACP, the National Rifle Association, and small local nonprofits. Loyola's Pullman.
All these truly different types of organizations might come under that label of corporation. And so the real difficulty is figuring out how to treat these different things under the Constitution.
In the early years of the Republic, the most important right accorded to corporations was the right of contract. Legal historian Eben Moglen.
And that right, the right to have contracts respected by the state, was the only federal constitutional right that the Supreme Court was thinking about before the Civil War.
The Civil War, however, coincided with an era of great industrialization and the need to raise great capital.
You realize how much this is going to cost the company?
That's not our worry. We're here to build a railroad.
With the invention of the railroad, you needed a great deal of capital.
Columbia's John Coffey.
And only the corporate form offered limited liability, easy transferability of shares, and continued perpetual existence.
Legal historian Eben Moglen adds that the end of the Civil War gave corporations a chance to pursue greater legal protection, too.
From the moment the 14th Amendment was passed in 1868, lawyers for corporations, particularly railroad companies, wanted to use that 14th Amendment guarantee of equal protection to make sure that the states didn't unequally treat corporations.
We're not talking here about the right to speak out on political issues. We're talking about equal treatment under state tax laws and things like that. The Supreme Court extended that protection to corporations, and over time it also extended to corporations some, but not all, rights guaranteed to individuals in the Bill of Rights. The court ruled that corporations have no right against self-incrimination, for instance, but that they do have a right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. Otherwise, as the Cato Institute's Ilya Shapiro puts it,
the police could storm down the doors of some company and take all their computers and their files.
For 100 years, corporations were not given any right of political speech in federal law. In fact, quite the contrary. In 1907, following a corporate corruption scandal in the presidential campaign, Congress passed a law banning any corporate involvement in federal election campaigns. That wall held firm for 70 years. The first crack came in a case that involved neither candidate elections nor federal law. In 1978, a sharply divided Supreme Court ruled for the first time that corporations have a First Amendment right to spend money on state ballot initiatives. Even after that, though, candidate elections remained free of direct corporate influence for decades. Only money from individuals and groups of individuals, known as political action committees, was permitted in federal elections. Then came Citizens United, the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision in 2010, extending to corporations for the first time full First Amendment free speech rights to spend money as they wish in candidate elections, federal, state, and local. The decision reversed a century-old legal understanding, unleashed a new flood of campaign cash, and uncorked a crescendo of controversy. It thrilled many in the business community, horrified campaign reformers, and provoked considerable mockery in the comedian classes.
If only there was some way to prove that corporations were not people, their inability to love.
That, of course, was The Daily Show's Jon Stewart. His shenanigans notwithstanding, there are serious people on both sides of this issue. Cato's Ilya Shapiro sees all corporations, when they spend on political campaigns, as merely associations of like-minded people.
Nobody is saying that corporations are living, breathing entities or that they have souls or anything like that. This is about protecting the rights of the individuals that associate in this way.
Countering that argument are those who note that individuals are perfectly free to give money to candidates and to spend unlimited amounts independently supporting those candidates, so they shouldn't need a corporation to express themselves. Some critics, like Loyola's Elizabeth Pullman, see a difference between for-profit and non-profit corporations. A non-profit corporation formed to advance particular political views is one thing, she argues. A large for-profit corporation is something else entirely.
There's no reason to believe that the people involved, shareholders, employees, even the directors or managers, have come together for an expressive purpose. Related to anything other than really what the business is doing.
And shareholders and employees, she observes, have no real recourse if they disagree with how corporate money is spent in campaigns. And then there's the money is not speech argument, Eben Moglen.
I think the real problem for those of us who see ourselves as strong First Amendment believers, as I do too, arises not so much because we think corporations shouldn't have rights as because we think that money isn't equal to speech. And we are now winding up using constitutional rules to concentrate corporate power in a way that's dangerous to democracy.
That, of course, is not how the Supreme Court majority sees its decision. The court has said that because speech is an essential mechanism of democracy, discrimination against any class of speaker is forbidden by the First Amendment. It matters not, the court said just this year, that some speakers, because of the money they spend on elections, may have undue influence on public policy. What is important is that the First Amendment protects both speech and speaker, and the ideas that flow from each. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
People who need people.
Being homeless is often associated with chronic health problems and frequent trips to the emergency room. In an attempt to reduce health costs, New York is using state Medicaid dollars to build housing for the homeless. It's one of the first states to do this, but it's caused a debate over whether housing is a form of health care and whether it should be paid for by insurance. Amanda Aronchuk of member station WNYC reports.
Lizette Encarnacion lives on the sixth floor of The Brook, an apartment building in the Bronx. It's a penthouse apartment, according to her, even if it's just a studio. She's lived here for 2 years now, but still sometimes forgets that this is her place.
I think that I'm somebody else and I'm ringing my own doorbell.
In every way, this tidy apartment at The Brook, decorated with stuffed animals and Christmas lights, is far from where Lizette used to live, back when she was homeless.
Under the bridge, I had a house under there.
Sometimes she slept in Prospect Park in Brooklyn, but mostly she lived beside an industrial canal.
I was smelly. I didn't think I smelled, but I made it like a home, but it wasn't kosher.
Lizette used to have a career in banking and was a homeowner of a real home where she lived with her husband and son. Then everything changed one night. Lizette's husband was an alcoholic. He came home drunk and angry.
And he came home, pulled me from my hair, and started just beating the hell out of me.
She says her husband threw her off the balcony while her son watched from the bed.
What saved me? Why I'm alive? The snow. Yes, it was a real bad storm. And it was really a lot of snow out. I can never forget that. If it wasn't for the snow, me and my baby would have been dead because I was 7 months pregnant.
You were pregnant with your second son?
Yes.
She had a traumatic brain injury, injuries to her face and arms. And for a while there, they weren't sure that she would make it. Lizette's baby had to be delivered by emergency C-section. She was in the hospital for months, but both she and her new son survived.
Were you able to look after your sons after you came out of the hospital?
My sister helped me raise my kids, and then I had times where I wonder and I leave.
After years of coming and going, she eventually left her kids with her sister and didn't return. All told, Lizette was homeless for a decade before she got her apartment at the Brook. And aside from the emotional costs and the physical wear of being on the streets for years, there are also the financial costs for homeless people like Lizette.
Were you going to the hospital while you were living
on
the streets?
A lot, yeah, because of my seizures. They was coming back to back, back to back. I used to get multiple seizures. I wasn't properly taking my medications.
And now it's under control.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, a lot of things changed. I'm no longer using. That's why I'm big as a house. I live in a clean environment. I'm part of society just a little bit.
More than half of the residents who live at the Brook were once homeless. It's called permanent supportive housing. It's an apartment complex with perks, social workers, security, an event planner.
And the doctor. We have a doctor on site, too.
A full range of services that help keep people healthy. The building is managed by Common Ground, and the group's director, Brenda Rosen, says that Lizette's frequent seizures would have likely led to emergency intervention when she was living on the streets.
EMS is going to come out, and they're going to triage her and take her to the emergency room. So all of those costs, from the time they come out to the time you get in the ambulance to the time you go, I mean, that's all expensive costs.
Being homeless in the city doesn't mean living off the grid. Services like police and shelters are needed, as are jails, where many people with severe mental illness end up. Rosen says the total figure per person is an estimated $56,000 a year.
That, you know, we as a society are paying for somebody to be on the streets. Versus coming into a permanent supportive housing building like the Brook, which costs roughly $24,000 a year.
Few people will dispute that Lizette is better off in her studio apartment than she was when she was living under a bridge. And it's far cheaper if she has a doctor downstairs than if she has to show up regularly in the ER. The question is, how do you pay to build this kind of housing?
So we'll start our public comment and question process now.
At a public meeting earlier this year, New York State Medicaid Director Jason Helgerson argued that federal Medicaid money already pays for housing through nursing homes and long hospital stays.
We pay for nursing homes. We pay to house people in hospitals for lengthy stays. In fact, we have people in hospitals today in this city who shouldn't be in hospitals if they had someplace to go and could be safely discharged.
New York State is investing $260 million in supportive housing over the next 2 years. But they haven't been able to convince the federal government to match that yet.
And I think that continues to be our fight, and I think we're beginning to get some traction on it. We still got some convincing to do.
But New York has the most expensive Medicaid program in the country. Dr. Bruce Vladek, who ran Medicaid in the 1990s, says the federal health insurance program is not permitted to pay for capital costs by law. And he says it's a bad idea.
Medicaid is supposed to be health insurance, and not every problem somebody has is a health care problem.
There are lots of Americans who need better housing, people whose health would certainly improve if they had a better place to live. But once you open that door, how do you close it? According to Dr. Vladek, a housing program should be paid for by a housing agency.
As a society, both in the private sector and the public sector, we are really cheap and niggling and resentful about paying for social services, and we're much more generous when it comes to paying for health services.
Which is why people are debating if housing qualifies as health care. At the moment, there's not enough housing money to go around for all the people who need it, like Lizette. She's done with living in the streets, but she still needs support.
Because I'm not ready to be out there.
She points towards a large window to the outside.
No, not yet.
She's not ready for a normal working life yet either. For now, the Brook is a place in between.
I stuck it out, and it's good. And God been real good to me, and the people that work here have been very good to me and patient, because I am not easy. I am not easy.
For NPR News, I'm Amanda Aronchik in New York.
There is a silent killer sweeping through Central America these days, and it has nothing to do with drug cartels or gang violence. It's a plant fungus known as coffee rust, or roya in Spanish. It's destroying the region's highly coveted coffee crop, causing more than $1 billion in losses and leaving hundreds of thousands unemployed. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
Outside the northern Guatemalan town of Alopa, near the Honduran border, farmer Edwin Fernando Diaz Vieira stands in the middle of his tiny coffee field. He says it was his lifelong dream to own a farm here. So 10 years ago, he left for Guatemala's capital, worked the night shift at a gas station for 6 years, and came back home to plant coffee.
Bonita mi finca, esto era una finca grande.
My farm was beautiful. It was big. But 2 years after I got back, coffee rust appeared and wiped out everything.
That was 2012, and it was his first crop. The rust took it all. The fungus roared over the hillsides, covered the valleys, and clung to the slopes of Guatemala's shady volcanoes, renowned for producing some of the world's richest Arabica, the smooth-tasting beans beloved by specialty coffee brewers.
Una bomba atómica que devastó todo.
Diaz says it was like an atomic bomb went off, wiped the whole place clean. In El Salvador, nearly three-quarters of all trees are infected with the fungus. In Costa Rica, more than 60%. And in Guatemala, coffee rust covers 70% of all trees, costing at least 100,000 jobs and a 15% drop in coffee output in just the last 2 years. Francisco Anzueto of Guatemala's coffee board, Ana Café, says coffee rust long has been in the region, but recently it became more aggressive.
Clima. Incremento de temperatura.
It's climate change, he says. Temperatures are up, and the fungus thrives in the heat, attacking the leaves of coffee trees, eventually choking off nutrients to the cherries that encase the beans. Most distressing is now it's hotter in the higher altitudes, where rust rarely ventured, and Guatemala's finest beans are grown. That got several producers, including Starbucks and Green Mountain, to team up with USAID. They've pooled more than $23 million to offer financing to repair crops and train farmers to fight the disease. I asked Mark Visaki, who heads USAID in Guatemala, if that's enough money.
No, it's a big problem. And if it's not crisis, it's very close to crisis.
Visaki says it will be a crisis when coffee prices spike and illegal immigration to the U.S. rises. Coffee prices are up, but mostly due to the prolonged drought in Brazil. And humanitarian organizations insist the current flood of immigrants out of Central America is not a product of rust-induced unemployment. But ask around Alopa by the Honduran border and you get a different answer. One farmer estimated that a third of the tiny town's residents are in the U.S. Jose Ramirez Mendez's house is guarded by a very skinny mud. His crop was wiped out 2 years ago by the fungus, and both he and his younger brother took off for the U.S. He got caught in Arizona and deported back.
Lo que tengo sembrado que no es la misma clase de lo que estaba.
He says now he planted a new coffee variety that is supposedly resistant to rust. His brother sends money when he can, but the family is deep in debt from the smuggler and the previously failed crop. Many farmers are turning to the new resistant plants, but the coffee quality is said to not be as good. Or they're pruning back trees with hope that new growth will improve resistance. Then there are others just getting out of the coffee business altogether. Humberto Mendez Perez digs a shallow hole, grabs a few black beans from a plastic cup, and tosses them in. He and his 7-year-old son and 10-year-old nephew do this repeatedly up a steep hillside. He lost his crop to rust last year and has to plant corn and beans if his extended family is to survive. Daniel McQuillan is an agricultural specialist with the charity CRS Catholic Relief Services.
It's really a nightmare from an environmental perspective.
His group is trying to help coffee farmers stay in the business. They give them vegetable seeds and fruit trees that also provide shade and some protection from rust to try and diversify their incomes. And they give them loans for bigger projects. Edwin Diaz bought 100 chickens with an $800 loan from CRS. His eggs are selling like crazy. He can't keep up with demand. Once he pays off the loan, the money then goes to another farmer.
Yo ahorita ya no quiero irme solo al café.
He says he doesn't want to depend solely on coffee anymore. He, too, has planted the rust-resistant strain of coffee, but he doesn't like the lower quality. Diaz takes me over to two small plants set aside. He says that's all that remains of his fine Arabica trees. He saved them just in case one day rust is gone from Guatemala, so he'll have a supply of good seeds.
Ponerlo en un museo.
If that day doesn't come, he jokes, he'll donate the plants to a museum so people will have some way to remember Guatemala's once fine coffee. Carrie Kahn, NPR News.